listeners, and welcome to Learn On Podcast, the science show by kids for kids. I'm your host, Jonsi, and I'm here today with a very special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Sarah Lazar. I am a neuroscientist at Massachusetts General Hospital, which is in Boston, Massachusetts, and it's affiliated with Harvard Medical School.
So you are a neuroscientist studying meditation, and my first question for you is, what drew you to this area of research and inspired you to study it?
It was a total left turn in my career. So for those of you who don't know what you want to do or it's a little fuzzy, don't worry. You don't have to know what you're doing. You can totally make left turns occasionally. So I was in grad school getting a PhD in microbiology, right? I was studying bacteria. Bacteria do not have brains, so bacteria do not meditate. And so anyway, so I was getting my PhD and I was training for the Boston Marathon with a friend of mine. And we overtrained and I destroyed my knee. And so I started practicing yoga purely as a form of physical therapy. This was about 25 years ago, and actually closer to 30 years ago now. And at that point, yoga was not well regarded. You know, yoga was like tinfoil hats, you know, for most people. And so I went to it and the teacher would say, oh, you know, this pose will do this for you and this pose will do that for you. And I was like, yeah, I'm here to stretch. I'm here to, you know, save my knee. But after just a few sessions, it was like, wow, there's way more to this than just stretching. I'd been a runner for many years. I always stretched before and after I ran, but it was really clear that it was having beneficial effects on me, that I was less reactive, I was calmer, things that used to trigger me weren't triggering me. And it was just, it was shocking how quickly it worked on me. And so I decided when I finished my PhD, I was like, I got to study this. I want to understand how this is working. And so I completely switched, left bacteria behind, and I started working on the brain. And yeah, I've been doing it ever since.
That's super cool. I love how it was just like a twist of fate that caused this huge spiral into the incredible research that you do right now. And I think that your work is so great because now that we have so much information and scientific evidence to demonstrate the concrete benefits of meditation and yoga, it's become so much more accessible and popular. And it's always been an ancient practice, right, with deep roots. But I think it's fantastic that now it's so much more widespread and so many people know about it and are able to practice it from the confines of their own home. So that's really awesome. And then to dive more into the science of it, I know one thing you've talked about a lot is neuroplasticity. So can you first tell us what exactly that means?
Right. So there's the formal definition and then the sort of general definition, which is how I'm usually using it. So neuroplasticity, technically, neuroplasticity just means neurons actually growing or changing or something's happening at the with the neurons themselves. What we know is that in the brain, they've done a bunch of studies with animals and they've shown that sometimes you can get really dramatic changes in behavior and learning and whatnot. And the changes are in the blood vessels or in some of the other cells that are in the brain. Like the brain's not just neurons. There's also astrocytes and glia and various other types of cells. And they support the neurons in various different ways. And so sometimes you can get really dramatic changes in those other types of cells or the blood vessels. And that's what then leads to the changes. And so with MRI, we can't tell which of those mechanisms are changing. You know, hopefully we think maybe it's the neurons, but we don't really know. It could be the blood vessels or the other types of cells. And so we're using neuroplasticity just to mean, okay, something in how the neurons are, or how the brain is working is changing. And so, and there's starting to be some evidence, like there is definitely some evidence that the neurons themselves are actually changing in some cases, but we don't know if that's accounts for everything.
That's really interesting. And I think I have not really heard too much about that other definition of neuroplasticity, considering glial cells and blood vessels in the brain. And I think that's so interesting because we always talk about the neurons, but not as much about the supporting cells. So I think it's really cool that neuroplasticity can also be looked at from that lens.
Yeah. And it's really clear from the animal literature, you know, it's not, mm-hmm. it's not just the neurons.
Yeah. So when you say that meditation changes the brain, how does it exactly do that? And so we talked a little bit about how the brain can change physically, but is this in a way that can manifest mentally or both, or how exactly does that work?
Right. So there's still a lot that needs to be figured out. The general idea is it's sort of like physical training of your body, right? You know, if you lift weights, these arm muscles are gonna grow and build up. And the same idea is true in the brain, that if there's certain neurons and neural pathways that you keep using, then they're gonna get strengthened. And perhaps the best evidence for this, well, there's all sorts of evidence for this. So for instance, if you look at athletes versus non-athletes, the motor cortex of athletes is bigger, more developed, more robust than non-athletes. And then as we get older and we become more sedentary, this motor cortex shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. So that's like one example. But then also there have been studies with jugglers, and two people who had never juggled before, they scan their brains, they tell them how to juggle, they scan their brains again, and they show that over the course of 3 months, the area of the brain that's involved in detecting visual motion increased. And then they told them to stop juggling, brought them back 3 months later, and that same region shrunk. So it's really clear. It's like, okay, you use it, it grows, or you stop using it, and it shrinks. And so now we've done a couple studies showing changes both in brain structure and in brain function. So just showing how the brain responds to certain stimuli changes over the course of 8 weeks, but also changes in both gray and white matter structure can happen over the course of 8 weeks.
That's really interesting. And I've always been fascinated by reading studies like your own and seeing that these concrete changes can be observed within 8 weeks or even a couple of months, which is crazy to think about, because I feel like in the past I've read about sources and studies that talked about neuroplasticity as something that we kind of lose with age, or it does not come to us that easily. So yeah, and you mentioned also a little bit about how stopping a certain behavior, like juggling, for example, can cause the region that had previously grown to shrink. So I'm not sure if any research has been done in a much longer term period, but how is the longevity of these changes? Is it something that needs to be maintained with time? Or like if someone has been meditating for many, many years and then they stop, will your brain still revert like that? Or are those changes permanent at that point?
Right. So probably there's a little bit of both. So we'll use math as an example, right? In high school, right? So there are certain things that I learned back in high school that I remember very clearly, even though I haven't used them in ages, but other things are gone. And I think because there's different types of benefits from meditation. One of the things that happens with meditation is something called decentering, which is where you kind of be able to sort of step outside of yourself and see what's going on from a distance. And the best way to think about this is think about like you and your friend group, and you know, one of your friends maybe has a habit, and you know that all your other friends know that they have this habit, but you'll say to that friend, oh, you know, you always do X. And that friend's like, no, I don't do that. And you're wrong. And you know, it's plain to all of you that, yeah, this person does this thing, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not clear to the person themselves. And with meditation, it's sort of stepping outside of ourselves and being able to see ourselves the way other people see us, right? And so we start to see some of those habits that we have, right? And the you know, things that we say and do that are perhaps not so skillful or you know, strange or whatever. And so we can start to see that, which is sort of interesting. And so once you get that sort of information, got it, right? And it doesn't matter if you stop meditating. And they've actually shown, because most of the research has been done with 8-week meditation programs. And what they've shown is that many people, you know, they go through the 8 weeks and they reduce, stress is reduced. And for a lot of people, it stays reduced. Even if they stop meditating, they've got that stress reduction. And often it's because there's something that is just so whatever for them. And then they realize, okay, I don't need to worry about that. And it's gone. And they don't worry about it anymore. But then there's other benefits of meditation where it seems like, yeah, you do have to continue practicing. And that's probably more sort of like the physical activity. So in terms of like, you know, the daily calm, and some of the health benefits and sort of the ability to see new things that you didn't see before, that may require ongoing practice.
I see. And, you know, as I reflect back on my personal experience with meditation, I think what I have experienced having meditated and like regularly meditating for like, I want to say 3 years now, I think I can also definitely relate to that. My journey in meditation and mental health is kind of similar to yours. I actually had this really incredible band teacher, and we used to have mindfulness Fridays, and this was before the pandemic hit, and it was just like a fun thing that we did during class. And you know, it was just nice. I didn't pay too much attention to it, but like it was always nice to do that. And then during the pandemic, I started learning about it more, and I was like, maybe this is something that I should do regularly for myself. Mm-hmm. So now I meditate like I still meditate frequently, but not for the same periods of time since I'm just like busier. But I feel like the changes that I've had in terms of the way that I see myself and my life have stayed more permanent, even though I may not be meditating as much anymore.
Yeah, and again, and that's anecdotal evidence that, again, we haven't proven that, but it's sort of, it kind of makes sense. There's certain things, like once you get it, you get it. Like once you know 2 + 2, it's like, okay, I got 2 + 2. So it's sort of a
And then something that we've also kind of dove into the past in our podcast here, and that you just mentioned now, is the different kinds of mindfulness practice. There's different disciplines of meditation, breath work, and yoga. And so you mentioned in the context of longevity and how much those benefits really stick with you even after you stop. But are there other kinds of distinctions between these practices that are more effective in resulting in certain health benefits?
Right. So there really hasn't been enough research to address that really yet.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely at this point, it's more just like, okay, they're all good. It's sort of like asking, okay, what's better, running or swimming or biking? And so there are definitely subtle differences, but for overall general health, they're all going to be pretty good. There's something called compassion meditation, and particularly for mental health, compassion meditation seems to be particularly useful. Often, especially here in America, we tend to be so hard on ourselves, right? And the hallmark of depression is beating yourself up. And within the Buddhist tradition, there's something called metta or loving kindness meditation. And traditionally, you do it for a benefactor, so someone who has helped you out, and it's just a way of sort of saying, thank you, may you be well, right? And sending it back to them, sending them good wishes. And then you do it for yourself, and then you do it for other people, so family, friends, neutral people. And what a lot of people found is doing it for yourself is incredibly healing, because again, because we tend to beat ourselves up, and other people beat us up emotionally. And just sort of saying, they always say, everything you need is inside of you, and you have to love yourself. And all of that is true. It's corny, it's pop psych 101, but it's true. And that's what compassion meditation is all about, is really learning to love yourself in a really deep, 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 profound way. And then being able to then send it out to others around you. So it's very, very healing in a lot of different ways.
That's really cool. I think I've done some meditations before that kind of center on that self-love and healing, but I don't think I've ever looked at compassion meditation as an individual practice of its own. So I'll definitely have to learn more about that. That sounds awesome.
So if you want to, for all of those you want to. So there's two people, Christopher Germer and Christy Neff. So they have created an 8-week program of just self-compassion. And so they both have websites, and on their websites they have a ton of free resources. So they have a ton of guided meditations, things you can read, general information about it. They have both sort of longer, like 10, 20, 30-minute meditations. They also have a bunch of short, like 3 to 5 minute meditations. So it's nice because not everyone has 30 minutes to practice. And so just 3 minutes sometimes can make a huge difference.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing. And yeah, we always have resources to go with our episodes. So I'll be sure to throw that in there. It'll be in the description and on our website. So you all should check that out if you're interested. Yeah. And then also, like, now I want to pivot a little bit more towards the scientific side, just because the neuroscience geek in me is excited to learn more. So this is coming from my AP Psych class, but I'm just curious because we've learned about many different ways of monitoring the brain, like MRI, EEG, fMRI, et cetera. So, what kind of tools do you use to monitor brain activity and meditation, and which are like most effective in demonstrating the changes that result over the course of your studies?
Right. So I have just used MRI. And there are definitely people who use both or who use all and whatnot. I mean, but just each is just like a whole nother. There's sort of each technique has quirks. There's a lot of information you need to know. So there are definitely people who do multiple techniques, but a lot of people just use one. And so I use MRI and fMRI. And they tell you different types of stuff. And so I don't know that one is better than the other. I feel like there's a lot of different ways of looking at the brain. And so they all give you different types of information. It's sort of like using different types of cameras, right? Or cameras from different angles. Just looking versus, like a magnifying glass or something like that. They're all telling you something slightly different. And so the big difference between EEG and MRI, EEG is looking directly at electrical activity, right? And so your neurons, every time they fire, there's an electrical pulse that gets propagated down the neuron. And so EEG is actually picking that up. Also something called MEG, which is so EEG is electroencephalogram and MEG is magnetoencephalogram. And they're very, very similar. So if you've done physics, you know the right-hand rule, right? And so you know that whenever there's an electric current, the magnetic current goes around it. And so the same is true with your neurons, right? So you get the electrical current going down the synapse of the neuron, and then there's a magnetic field around it. And so you can look at both. And so both of those are good because they're actually getting the activity of the neurons. The bad, the con of both of those is that they have really poor spatial resolution. So you know, okay, it's happening somewhere in this general area of the brain, but you really can't pinpoint where that activity is. Versus MRI, you have really good spatial resolution, but really poor temporal resolution. So with EEG, you can get millisecond, you know, which is because the neurons are firing at millisecond. fMRI, we're actually looking at blood flow, because the idea is that once a neuron fires, the blood flows there because, you know, it's active and it needs food and needs to get rid of the waste. And so the blood goes there. And so what we're really measuring with MRI is the change in the blood flow. And so that takes a couple of seconds. So it's an indirect measure, which is not so good, but we know exactly where it's happening. And there are some people who put the two together. Like you can actually collect EEG and MRI at the same time, but it's very technically complicated and there's a lot of issues with it. So it's why it's not more widespread. But then slowly those hurdles are coming down. And so there's more and more of that, because again, they're sort of telling you different things and putting them together gets some really cool pictures of what's happening in the brain. Sorry, that's probably long answer.
No, that was great. And I also didn't realize that the right-hand rule would be kind of used in neuroscience. I still remember I had a quiz on the right-hand rule in physics that I was so nervous about a year ago. And I was like, I wonder if I'm going to remember this, but you know.
Right, and that's one of the things, like I had not used the right-hand rule in 20 years. And all of a sudden, yeah. I'm just like, oh, right-hand rule. Okay, yeah, I remember that, kind of sort of vaguely. Like you learn, right? And actually, it turns out right now in neuroscience is really, really interesting because, you know, it's been very much heavy on the biology, but the physics and the chemistry, like the tools. And so one of the coolest, hottest topics in neuroscience right now is zapping the brain with electrical pulses. And what you can do is called transcranial direct current stimulation, or TDCS. And there's another way, you can also use sonogram. There's a bunch of different ways to do it. But the idea basically is, okay, if you just like zap the brain with a little pulse of energy, what happens? And what they found is that, you know, it's kind of like a shot of caffeine. It's like, okay, just put the energy into the system. And so then like you're more alert and you're better, you know, if it's done at the right time and right place, you can enhance learning and whatnot. And so now some people are trying to do it with meditation to say like, okay, can you enhance meditation by zapping people at the right time in the right place? And I don't know that anyone's actually published anything with it yet. I haven't seen anything really concrete and like with it, but there's definitely a lot of interest in that area.
That's so cool. This is also like, there's just so many connections to what I'm doing in school, because for history, I just wrote a paper. It was like our final big project paper. And I chose to explore the complicated history of electroconvulsive therapy in America and how it affected psychiatry. So yeah.
Yeah, no, I do. And like ECT, like, you know, very controversial, but it's kind of sort of modified, you know, it's still kind of used, because not the way it used to be done. We used to like chop up the brain basically, the frontal lobes, but there are definitely some people who really benefit from getting a shock of electricity and stuff. Yeah, and yeah, definitely. Because that's the thing, again, it's an electrical thing. And also like new ways of getting that signal out, those electrical signals. And again, because like the EEG, they're getting better and better, better at localizing those signals. And yeah.
Yeah, no, the interdisciplinary approach to neuroscience always fascinates me so much. So yeah, this was kind of an off tangent that I wasn't expecting to talk about, but I'm really glad that we did. So
engineers, like, okay, neuroengineering, like that is like, again, a huge field right now, you know, so like developing tools to study the brain, big, 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 big field.
Yeah, definitely. So then also back to kind of the medicine of it, we talked a little bit about the mental health benefits. Are there any physical benefits that you can get from meditating, from the changes that you have to your brain? I know one thing that I've kind of read about is preventing neurodegeneration. So I'm just interested in learning more about that.
Yeah, no, definitely. So that was one of our first studies, was we looked at the brains of long-term meditators versus controls. And we saw it wasn't the whole brain, but there were definitely certain parts of the brain where there was way more gray matter in in the older people, because what happens is that the whole front half of your brain kind of shrinks as we get older. And again, it's like use it or lose it, right? So if you keep exercising into your old age, yeah, you lose some muscle mass, but basically you'll keep most of it. And so that's what we were seeing in the brains of the long-term meditators, is that, there are some brain regions that were completely preserved, and other brain regions that, yeah, they were going down, but they weren't going down as fast as they were in the controls. And then a couple of other people have done similar studies, and again, shown that, again, there's certain brain regions that are definitely preserved in meditators compared to controls. So that's a really good thing. And then we recently did a study where we took people 65 to 80 and we taught them how to meditate, and we showed enhancements in cognition. And those were preserved over 2 years. So you can teach old dogs new tricks. And it's never too late to start. And so that's that. But then also, but there's other people who've shown that meditation, it changes your telomeres, right? And it has to do with stress and disease, but also longevity. So the idea is that, do you know about telomeres? Do you know about these things?
Oh yeah, AP biology is like drilled it into my head. Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, excellent. Okay, good, cool. Yeah, so, but for those of you who don't know, so the end of chromosomes, they're just raggedy. And so, but there's these things on the ends to keep them from just fraying away. And so, and meditation helps preserve those and lengthen your chromosomes, which is really cool. Because again, for longevity and just general health, there's also, it definitely has impacts on, like, say, cortisol and some of the other like inflammatory proteins and pathways. So it does seem like it has some effects on that as well.
That's super cool. Yeah. And especially because there have been so many studies demonstrating that just a few minutes of meditation a day for like 8 weeks, for example, which isn't that long in the grand scheme of things, can have all these health benefits. So like you said, it's never too late to start. And it's always something that we encourage here on the podcast. And I feel like there's so many benefits that you can get from it that are untapped. Yeah. And then also on the topic of age. So you mentioned that there are still benefits as if someone's older and they're starting meditation. And then I've also read about how like younger brains usually have more neuroplasticity, from my understanding at least. So I'm curious to learn about how a child meditating, how their brain would change compared to an older adult doing the same protocol.
Yeah, it's hard to know. It's really hard to know, because the brains, forget meditation for a moment. If you just look at the brains of people from birth to 25 years, we know that there's all sorts of really large changes happening in the brain over those time periods. Just really, really big changes that you can see at the group level. So, probably it would depend a little bit on the age, what exactly was happening, because even like a 6-year-old versus an 8-year-old meditating, that's probably going to have different effects just because the brain is wired differently at those different ages, right? And also, does a 6-year-old understand the instructions the same way an 8-year-old does?
Right.
they do exactly the same. It's hard to know, right? And so there just hasn't been enough research. There's been very little with brains, kids and brains. I think there's only been like one or two studies where they've taken, well, in meditation, they've taken kids, scanned their brains, taught them how to meditate, scanned them again. There's only been one or two of those studies. And so it's really too early to say, okay, what happens at different ages?
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense for sure. But yeah, there's all the benefits that we discussed are really, really huge. And as there's even more and more studies being conducted about it, and as you said, like neuroengineering, figuring out new ways to actually measure these benefits, I think this is such an interesting field and there's so much more to do from here. And so my kind of last question to wrap everything up is, now that we've talked about all the benefits and really understood the science behind it, how can someone who is interested in getting into meditation but doesn't have any experience with it yet start to develop a routine in order to maximize these possible benefits?
Yeah. So right now it's a great time. There are 50 million apps. It's a bit of exaggeration, but not much. And there's literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of apps that you can get on your phone. One of the most popular ones is something called Headspace. It's $10 a month. And so the pros and cons of that is, it's just one guy. Like, all the recordings are by one guy named Andy Petticombe. And the vast majority of the meditations are just 10 minutes. His big thing is you just have to practice 10 minutes a day. And what's cool about his website is that so you're having problems at school, so here's how you can use meditation at school. You're having problems at home, here's how you can use meditation at home. You're having trouble at work, here's how you use meditation at work, right? In relationships and, et cetera, et cetera. So it really helps you how to apply mindfulness, right? So that's one of the benefits of that. I think you can get like a 30-day free trial often with Headspace.
Yeah. And actually, just to jump in, there's I actually use Headspace, and it was like what got me into meditation. And I'm super glad that you brought it up. Like, I still have it. And there's another organization that I work at called Peer Health Exchange, and they actually offer a free subscription for teens. There's like a verification process, but it's pretty short. So I'm really glad that you brought it up, and I'll have it in the description too for people who want free Headspace. So yeah,
excellent, fantastic.
Continue.
Cool, awesome. So then there's another one that's completely 100% free. It's called Insight Timer, right? It's very simple. And what's cool about that one is that, so A, it's free. B, there are literally thousands of teachers and, you know, male, female, young, old, there's monks, there's different, there's like, there's Buddhist meditation, but there's also, you know, Hindu and Sikh and all sorts of, you know, sort of just new age. There's all sorts of different traditions of different, you know, meditation traditions, different lengths. So they have, you know, 3 minute meditations, they got 10 minute meditations, they've got 20, 30, 40 minute, 1 hour meditations. They also have a lot of just talks about meditation or about mental health. They have a whole section for, if those of you want trouble having sleep, falling asleep, there's a whole section on your meditations for sleep, meditations for stress. It's a bunch of different topics. And so, like I said, it's completely free. The downside of it is that it's like, oh my, like there's not an easy, you know, the ones for sleep and stress are sort of right there on top. But if you want to find something else, it's a bit of wading through and trying to find things. But it's just, it's a fantastic resource. And they also just have a timer, right? So if you just want to set a timer, you know, for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and it has a log so you can keep track of how much you're practicing. And it can just be silent. They've got bells to go off every few minutes if you wanted to do that. You can also have like the background, like birds chirping or water running, stuff like that. So that's, there's, you know, it's very flexible and it's free. So that's one I use.
That's super cool. Yeah. And actually this is a little sneak peek for our listeners, but we have a new season coming very soon on digital health. And I think it's really cool how in this new era of technology, there's so many more resources that we have for health and medicine and increasing the accessibility for mental health overall. So yeah, those are super great resources. We'll also have that in the link in the description. And overall, it was really great talking with you. I learned a lot, and this has been a really memorable conversation.
Oh, cool. I'm glad.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.